Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is side two of For the Record program number 406, an interview with John Loftus, the author of The Belarus Secret and Valhalla's Wake, and along with Mark Aron's Unholy Trinity and The Secret War Against the Jews. John, welcome back to our airwaves.
Well, thank you much.
In the first side of our broadcast, we were chatting about John's lawsuit against Sami Al-Arian, a Palestinian, or alleged, we should say, Palestinian terrorist, and how that led to the March 20th, 2002, Green Quest raids, which in turn engendered a lawsuit against many powerful members of the Saudi elite, with John Loftus, my guest, as the intelligence advisor to this ongoing lawsuit on behalf of the survivors of the victims of September 11th. John, I'd like to jump back briefly and add a couple of items concerning an article that is on your website about the Thyssen-Bornemisza Empire. Now, the Thyssen-Krupp, by the way, K-R-U-P-P, the famous German armorers, in investing, first of all, just briefly review for people that might be just tuning in, Thyssen-Bornemisza, now Thyssen-Krupp, and the financial triangle that was involved in that.
Yeah, essentially it was the Wall Street investors after World War I took their money out of America, partly causing the Great Depression, and they were trying to buy up companies overseas that could have influence with their governments to have them set up cartels that were forbidden in America because of Teddy Roosevelt's trust-busting laws. So the Thyssen Company got in bed with, you know, American investors like Nelson Rockefeller and others, and that was the tip of the spear. These were the companies in Germany that took American dollars and invested in the Nazi Party. They didn't really like Nazis. They quite frankly preferred the conservative Catholic Party, but then they spread the money around. Hitler might be useful, a dog on a chain, keep the trade unions down, keep the communists at bay. But then Hitler broke the chain, and what were the companies going to do? They had their steel mills built there. They couldn't immigrate with the steel mill, so they played along with Hitler, and they set up this great financial scam to get their money out, and it worked. ThyssenKrupp got all their money out from the Third Reich and reestablished themselves, and now they're the wealthiest conglomerate in Europe.
Right after World War II, the manager of the, and I may be mispronouncing, the Bank für Handel und Schifffahrt discovered an interesting bit of information about how his bank was being used in connection with this cartel. Could you describe that and what happened to him?
Yeah, the bank manager, a Dutch guy, discovered that his little bank in Amsterdam was nothing more than a front for the Third Reich to launder their money out after the collapse in 1945. And so he went to New York, talked to his counterpart, who was Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current president. But somehow when he arrived in New York, he had a heart attack. A very healthy man was found dead. And that wasn't the only case. There was a Dutch reporter, Eddie Rover, who went to investigate this, and he was on his way to the Thyssen offices in London, and he too had a heart attack. So, you know, it's extremely suspicious that everyone that's tried to dig into the Thyssen-Bornemisza case has ended up with a heart attack.
Interesting. The base for the Thyssen-Bornemisza empire is actually Lugano, Switzerland, which is also a major international funny money center that is also, or was at one point, the epicenter for the Altaqua milieu, which figures in the lawsuit and the Operation Green Quest raids of 2002. John, just very briefly, in some of the deep politics that's involved in the background of the creation of Saudi Arabia, the petroleum industry, which is obviously something that is a dominant element in world politics, but you mentioned a little bit about the genesis of Saudi Arabia. And
sure, the same people in Wall Street that funded the infant Nazi Party also funded a group of very racist thugs in Arabia called the Wahhabis.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most militant sect. It's actually been declared a heresy more than 60 times. But Wahhabism came to be one of the dominant forces in the group once they got, you know, American money to buy guns. And in 1922, we wanted to get a toehold in the Arabian Peninsula because the British oil companies were dominating it. So we gave guns to the Wahhabi terrorists, and they threw the Hashemite dynasty out of Mecca and Medina and took the country over and named it after themselves. Ibn Saud was the leader of the tribe, and he called it the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So essentially, Saudi Arabia is nothing more than a group of terrorists that were funded with corrupt Wall Street money that decided they wanted to have a you know, an oil bastion on their own. Well, the problem is that years later, that, you know, one-third of the royal family still stayed loyal to the American funders because, quite frankly, you know, we protected them and covered their butts. But the right-wing third was true to the Wahhabi faith. Now, the only people that practice the Wahhabi faith are the Taliban and the Saudis. They are the Wahhabism is to Islam as the Ku Klux Klan is to Christianity. Wahhabism is an extreme sect. It's anti-women. It's anti-Jewish. It's anti-democracy. It is an absolute perversion of the peaceful Islamic faith. One of my dear friends is Sheikh Palazzi of Italy. He's the senior Muslim cleric in all of Italy. And he said that, you know, Wahhabism is just a terrible enemy of Islam. But they have so much money that the Saudis have been taking over, you know, chairs of Middle Eastern studies in major universities, funding 80% of the mosques in America, and quite frankly, funding terrorist groups. You know, not those, just those willing to kill Jews, but those willing to kill Palestinians who want to make peace with Jews.
I'd like to talk more about Islam and Wahhabism in just a second, but real quickly, for the benefit of relatively newer and relatively young listeners, two key names in the founding of Saudi Arabia, one that some might know, one they probably don't, Alan Dulles and Jack Fieldy. Could you give us a thumbnail bio of each and how they relate to the founding of Saudi Arabia?
Sure. Alan Dulles was a really corrupt degenerate in our State Department, later became head of CIA. He is the guy that apparently recruited Saddam Hussein as a CIA agent years later.
Alan Dulles actually recruited Saddam Hussein?
Well, he was in charge of Miles Copeland, and Miles Copeland actually did the recruitment. But Saddam was on our payroll in those early days.
Fascinating.
You know, any thug that would carry guns to keep the oil safe for Wall Street was... Alan Dulles was just a really despicable guy. His British partner was worse. Jack Fieldy was a right-wing fascist. He actually spent time in Britain, prison in Britain during World War II as a Nazi agent. Left the British Secret Service and became a Muslim, and it was Jack Fieldy who negotiated the first oil contract between Saudi Arabia and Aramco, the Arab American oil company. Jack Fieldy's son is better known to history as Kim Fieldy, the guy who was so disgusted at his fascist father that Kim became a communist and the highest-ranking communist agent inside the British Secret Service.
There's an article that you posted on your website. I know, actually, this was a letter that was posted on the bulletin board, but there's been a lot of discussion post-September 11th about what Islam is and what Islam isn't and what the Quran says or what it doesn't say and the literal and violent interpretation of Wahhabism. One of the things that you discuss in that letter, and I'd like you to elaborate on this, is a very important body of Islamic law called the Hadith. And the difference between what the Hadith says about Islam's role, attitude toward Jews, Christians, women, and differentiate for us the difference between Wahhabism and, quote, real Islam, unquote, as it has generally been recognized. And
so the Prophet Muhammad was a very decent, upstanding guy, and he said, the Quran is a beautiful but ambiguous poem. It can be interpreted in 72 different ways, 71 of them false. In order to make sure there were no false interpretations, the early Islamic scholars, within 100 years of Muhammad's death, interviewed everyone that knew him when he was alive and took down affidavits about what he said so that Muhammad's words and life example would be the path to interpreting the Quran. And when you read the Hadith, it's almost like an encyclopedia of everyone that knew Muhammad.
John, spell that for us, if you would.
H-A-D-I-T-H.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
And it's a very different view of Islam. For example, the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia won't allow women to work or have their own business or even leave their home without being escorted by a male. Well, Muhammad was a very different guy. He worked for his wife his entire life. She was an international trader who ran camel caravans up to Damascus. Muhammad was a stay-at-home dad. He raised three daughters. And he was the first religion in the world that required that women have the right to control their own bodies, that the right to contract, the right to divorce. Not what we call feminism by today's standards, but enormously progressive. So his attitude towards women has been completely turned around by the Taliban and the modern Saudi Arabian people.
How about towards Jews?
Oh, it's amazing. Muhammad always respected the Jewish people. He would stand and bow when a Jewish funeral would pass. He married a Jewish wife, but forbade any attempt to forcibly convert Jews. They were the peoples of the book, And the Quran said that the children of Israel will live in their land until the end of time, when Allah will gather them all together. And that the Jews will have their holy place in the west, meaning Jerusalem, while we shall have ours in the east, meaning Mecca. So Muhammad saw himself as evolutionary, building on this beautiful, historical, God-given base of Judaism and Christianity.
If you would tell us, too, John, because there's been propagandizing by the Christian right about what Islam is and isn't, and in turn a reaction on the part of Muslims.
Just because there's really two Islams. Mm-hmm. For the first 1,000 years, Islam was a very tolerant, peaceful religion, very progressive. If you wanted to go to law school or med school, you went to a Muslim university, you studied with a Jewish professor, very scientific. The very words for magazine, medicine, algebra, all come from the Arabic, from this great period. But 300 years ago, Islam changed. And it changed because the dictators said, let's ban the printing press. Let's keep our people illiterate so we can keep them under our thumb. Well, illiterate people can't read the hadith. The most they can do is memorize a few verses of the Quran. Well, you take any great holy book, the Torah, the Bible, the Quran, and you take verses out of context, you can pervert it. And that's what the Wahhabis did. For the last 300 years, Wahhabism has been the cult of perverting the Quran. And it was declared as a heresy more than 60 times. But today, we have all these terrorist groups that are believing in the Wahhabi, they call it the Salafist view now. And they really don't know what it means. They don't know what a heresy is to their own religion. I think what's happening now is literacy rates are rising, particularly in Israel among Palestinians, that as people can read the hadith, they say, oh, wow, we get way off in the path. That Muhammad was a guy who was very tolerant, very pacifistic. I think you're going to see the beginning of the Muslim Renaissance. As literacy rates are climbing now, people are less and less susceptible to the temptations of the Wahhabi terrorists.
Underscoring a couple of points and developing one further, the traditional Muslim attitude toward Christians, also people of the book, am I correct, according to Muhammad?
Oh, sure. There was a delegation sent by the Pope to meet Muhammad, and they were very surprised at how gentle and kind he was. And the Christian said, well, where can we say Mass? And Muhammad said, well, right here in the mosque. This is a house consecrated to God. Where else would you pray?
What's striking is the difference between the popularized view of Islam, and it, not only in the Wahhabi domain, but also among reactionary elements in the United States. We need to develop some of the names there any further. I had a couple of questions, John. I was aware that algebra was actually an evolution of the Arabic term al-jabar. I was not aware of the Arabic genesis of magazine and medicine. Could you develop that for us quickly?
Yeah, I don't remember what the Arabic words are, but I read in an ethnological study on this, that one of the good books in this area is Ralph Patai's The Arab Mind, where he gives a history of that. But for a simple book for lay readers to read, you're going to laugh, but it's called The Idiot's Guide to Islam. It's a very gentle book explaining what the tenets of Islam are, and they're nothing to do with terrorism, nothing to do with, you know, jihad or forced war. In fact, most of the stuff that the suicide bombers have is heresy to Islam. The whole idea of suicide is one of the 5 great sins of Islam. You know, the idea of attacking an innocent is a sin against Islam. Against women and children is absolutely forbidden. So this is what happens when you have a great progressive society that all of a sudden was banned from reading the interpretive texts of their own faith. And it became perverted.
One of the things you write about in The Secret War Against the Jews, and something that I think people should be aware of in connection with the unfolding events in the Middle East, and we're going to get to some breaking news that you have for us after this question, but the Saudi funding of the PLO, and in particular the Saudi king's attitude toward the Palestinians.
Yeah, King Fahd was terrified that the Jews and the Palestinians would make peace. And he wanted to stop it at all costs, because there had never had, in a generation, there hadn't been anything resembling an Arab democracy. And the Jews had put all the Arab kids in school from kindergarten to university. They were exposed to Western business, Western values. They were exposed to democracy. This would be a cancer in Arab society, because who would ever elect Saddam Hussein or the Saudi royal family as their leaders? So King Fahd said, next to the Jews, we hate the Palestinians the most, because this was the first group that had a chance of establishing their own country, their own culture. Because for the first time in 300 years, we have a highly literate Arab class. The Palestinian Arabs in Israel have a literacy rate more than 97%. It's one of the highest in the Arab world. And this terrified King Fahd. He wanted to wreck it, and he wanted to kill not just the Jews, but any Palestinian who was willing to work with Israel for peace. That's why he hired suicide bombers, groups like Samuel Aryan's Islamic Jihad. And every time that Israel and Palestine got close to the peace, the Saudis would wreck it by pumping more money through their murder-for-hire pipeline so that Samuel Aryan could send more suicide bombers into Palestine and Israel and wreck the peace process. Very cruel, but very effective.
PLO and its Saudi funding source, real quickly.
Yeah, essentially the PLO was a group that the Soviets funded when the communism collapsed. There was a brief lull when the Oslo peace process took place. And then the Saudis began to write checks to all the former communist terrorist groups to take them over and subsidize them. To really simplify a very complex story, the Saudi and Iranians fund groups like Al-Qaeda, the Pakistanis supply them, and the Iraqis train them.
Let's get turned to some breaking news in connection with the Middle East. What can you tell us about Osama bin Laden? Where is he? What's happened to him?
Interesting story. One of our Arab allies donated two kidney dialysis machines to the Taliban, and one of them is still in the hospital in Kabul, but the other one was for Osama bin Laden's personal use, only his machine was rigged, so it poisoned him. Instead of getting better, he gets sicker and sicker. It was actually a very clever strategy. Instead of, if we killed him, we would have made him a martyr. If we captured him, he'd be a ransom target. What we did, in effect, was cripple him. One of my friends in the intelligence community said, you will never again see Osama bin Laden's face on television. No more videotapes, only audio tapes. I said, why? He said, because Osama is yellow. He is literally yellow with jaundice. In the Islamic world, that's considered a satanic disease. He is cursed by Allah. So Osama is in and out of comas in a cave in Afghanistan. He wakes up enough to dictate a few words into a tape recorder, an audio tape recorder. But it's one of those solutions that really might have worked out for the best, because in the Islamic world, Osama ran away. He's afraid to show his face. Now, we've really taken Al-Qaeda apart. We caught the number three guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed,
right,
who, by the way, was an old acquaintance of Samuel Aryan's group. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed now is talking like a waterfall. He has confessed that he was the guy who planned the Trade Towers 1, Trade Towers 2, the call, the attack on the embassies. He's trying to save himself, the gas chamber. So he's giving up everyone in Al-Qaeda.
So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had actually known Sami Al-Aryan, or was an associate of Sami Al-Aryan's, according to your
information. In fact, yeah, when Sami lived in North Carolina, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed moved there and went to school. He went to the mechanical engineering department at North Carolina A&T, and in that, the mechanical engineering department is one building. It was Sami's brother-in-law, Mazen al-Najjar, who was a tutor in the same department at the same time.
Of course, recently, as I'm speaking on April 13th of 2003, the war in Iraq is still on, although it has been the outcome has been decided. There is still combat. There is a lot of speculation on a number of different fronts. First of all, the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction, one of the most controversial elements of the Iraqi situation. I've discussed that on a number of different broadcasts. Are you in a position to tell us anything?
Yeah, very much. I think the whole issue of chemical and biological warfare, red herrings, those things really don't work against modern armies. The real reason we were in Iraq, the big rush, was that a little over a year ago, we intercepted a North Korean telephone call to Libya. And the North Koreans were terrified. They were saying, oh, my God, what if the Americans go into Iraq? They'll find the records about our nuclear program in Libya. And who is going to pay the Iraqi scientists in Libya if Saddam Hussein is overthrown? So we had several tapes like that. We confronted the North Koreans last October, and they were shocked and blurted out they really did have a nuclear program. Now, what's happened is the North Koreans were developing, they had a breeder reactor that made weapons-grade plutonium, but low-level stuff. The plutonium was shipped to Iraq to a place called Al-Tawaitha, and that's where our troops found radiographical traces of weapons-grade plutonium. That's where the North Korean nuclear material was enhanced and upgraded to make weapons-grade plutonium. The stuff then was shipped to Libya. Colonel Gaddafi has a hollowed-out mountain that is bomb-proof, and that's where they want to build an underground nuclear bomb factory for terrorism.
So, in other words, discussing an axis of evil, there actually have been some commercial...
Yeah, the whole axis of evil concept came out of the nuclear files that, you know, Iran was building their own stuff, North Korea and Iraq were the real leaders. Libya was just a hidey hole.
Interesting. There is a documentary film that has been produced by a fellow who was operating under the auspices of Columbia University, and I'd just like to ask you off the cuff. I was reading an article that discussed that documentary called Stealing the Fire, and that was discussing the Iraqi nuclear program, and I'm going to get lambasted for even talking about this in many of the progressive radio stations that carry the program, but documentary maintains that actually Saddam Hussein did get critical information about the manufacture of nuclear weapons, and that it was software, and that it came from the old Degussa axis, which in turn had been involved with nuclear and nuclear projects on behalf of Adolf Hitler, and actually a fellow named Dr. Gernot Zippe, who had developed the gas centrifuge, had a protege named Karl-Heinz Schaub, who was described as the contact point between Saddam Hussein and Degussa, and people like Alfred Beecher, who was a former SS scientific officer and then became a West German nuclear export attaché.
Nothing that exotic, I'm afraid. I spent yesterday going through the a lot of the CIA and other intelligence agencies' old files for it. It turns out that the Russians built the first Iraqi test reactor at Al Tawaitha back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Then the French came in, built up Osirak. We bombed, the Israelis bombed that, and then the Russians rebuilt it. And then we bombed that in the first Gulf War.
Right.
Almost all the technology came from France or Russia. You know, but it's the filthy four. You get France, Russia, Germany, and China. And in each of those countries, you have huge corruption within the military-industrial side. They can bribe politicians. Their job is to sell arms exports around the world, and among the arms are nuclear arms.
Right.
They made a huge profit in this trade. Extraordinary amounts of corruption in those four countries. And Saddam was very clever. He manipulated them. He said to France, Russia, and China, I will give you rights for oil exploration in Iraq, you know, provided you protect me.
Mm-hmm.
So, quite frankly, they were giving him kickbacks out of the Oil for Food program. And some of the UN countries went along with it because the Oil for Food program in Iraq was the biggest cash cow UN bureaucrats ever had. 2% of all the oil pumped out of Iraq went right into the pockets of the UN bureaucracy as their administrative fee. So they didn't want to see Saddam overthrown. And quite frankly, they were walking by weapons of mass destruction pretending they didn't see him.
Interesting.
Hideous amount of corruption.
Jacques Chirac, by the way, was the French president when the Osirak deal was first arranged. So it sort of...
You know, I love the French people, but French politicians I'm opposed to for environmental reasons. I think they are a waste of valuable oxygen.
Well, and that I'm sure will engender myself to some of the members of the listening audience. So in other words, in answer to my sort of lengthy question, Degussa and the Gernot Zippe information about that, the link to Iraq is on the money, and the stealing the fire. So that actually did exist, that connection.
Well, less so from Degussa, I think. I don't know if I agree with all of that in the book, but
okay.
To be fair, I haven't read it, so I have to sit down and maybe come back with an informed opinion.
All right, it's actually a documentary film, and there's there is some discussion of that connection in the book by Kenneth Timmerman. Oh, The Death Lobby, that's what it's called, The Death Lobby. Very quickly, Saddam Hussein, alive, dead, what happened? What's your information?
Yeah, no, he died. I was giving a speech in St. Petersburg on March 19th and said, don't worry, the war isn't starting tonight. Tonight is only the decapitation strike. We have 280-plus CIA paramilitary and special forces guys are going to try and end the war quickly by taking out the heads of the regime. As I was speaking, we had a local contact who tipped off U.S. special forces that Saddam and his sons were going to sleep in a certain bunker that night. Now, we videotaped them coming in, and we got good photos of their ears. It's the only way to tell the real Saddam family from their body doubles. So the ear photos were sent to Langley, Virginia via satellite, confirmed that it was Saddam. And so there was 100% confirmation these were the guys. Now, what happened is two stealth bombers dropped four bombs. Each one was 2,000 pounds apiece, but they were staggered to come down several seconds apart. These were later laser-guided bombs, and they all went through the same hole. So the first bomb went through the villa on top, two stories, then through about 8 feet of dirt, and detonated on the roof of the bunker. The bunker's about 8 feet thick with reinforced concrete and steel. The second bunker buster made a bigger hole. The third one made the hole bigger. The fourth one punched through. So what we had in effect was a chimney, all right? Then the Special Forces guys put their laser in the middle of the chimney hole and programmed those coordinates via satellite to some 32 cruise missiles that were already in flight. Now, the new cruise missile can fly through a window that's 1 meter wide. We flew 32 cruise missiles down that chimney into the bunker below. It created what's called a thermobaric effect, a series of concussive shock waves that are forced deeper and deeper into the bunker and down through the tunnels. So even if Saddam Hussein was inside a safe, the concussion would have killed him. It would have snapped his brain stem, collapsed his lungs, and forced his organs out through his mouth. A half an hour later, Special Forces people videotaped the rescue crews arriving, digging through the rubble. They brought out the body of Saddam Hussein with a mask over his face so people couldn't see how badly he was injured. Then British intelligence intercepted a phone call from an Iraqi doctor calling for a Russian doctor to come help immediately because a senior member of the regime had been very badly hurt and his heart had stopped. So, and then for the next 2 weeks, there was not a word heard from Saddam Hussein or his kids. So it was military intelligence concurred that most likely Saddam Hussein, Hussein and Kudeh died that night. So what happened last Wednesday? Well, CNN and NBC ran a story that, oh, gee, Osama was seen, you know, coming out in broad daylight to meet his kids in a site less than a mile from American troops.
You so mean Saddam Hussein?
By the way, that's suspicious.
Yeah.
So they ran a silly story. Apparently it was Saddam's body double that had a job three blocks away and might have been walking through the park. Anyway, you know, it was just, if you think that they will drop some bombs just to be safe. It was just four routine bombs, no bunker busters, no tomahawks. But the press loved the story, only it was totally false. Now, late at night, U.S. intelligence asked Fox and MSNBC to read a statement where U.S. intelligence said they believed that the whole episode was just something that Iraqi counterintelligence had conned up trying to find out how effectively the U.S. government was monitoring walkie-talkies and things below ground. It was just a con game.
Fascinating. John, we're almost out of time. Are there any points that you wanted to make, any points of information that I have not touched on? We've just got a couple of minutes left. Or any editorial points or exhortations that you'd like to present to the audience?
Yeah, I think that people should not confuse Saudi Arabia or Wahhabism with Islam. That there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. Only 15% are Arabs. Only 1% of the 15% are Wahhabis. We have a tiny, very wealthy, sick cult. It's as if David Duke became king of Texas and tried to export the Ku Klux Klan around the world. That's what we're dealing with, Wahhabism. And the sooner it fades, the better.
And by the way, David Duke, one of his organizations was present in the International Answer Anti-War Coalition that's been a focal point of some controversy in the U.S. John, I want to thank you for your time and for your ongoing heroic efforts. Once again, give us very quickly your website.
It's www.john-loftus.com, J-O-H-N-L-O-F-T-U-S.
Once again, people can support your efforts through that website. We've been speaking with John Loftus, Justice Department investigator, intelligence advisor to the lawsuit against the Saudi elite, author of Belarus Secret and Valhalla's Wake, and with Mark Ahrens of Unholy Trinity and the Secret War Against the Jews. John, it has been a pleasure speaking with you, and once again, I think the human race owes you a great debt of gratitude.
I'm just a country lawyer who's too stupid to charge for the work I do. I do it all for free.
All righty. Well, thanks for your efforts. We've been speaking with John Loftus. This concludes, For the Record, 406, Side 2. And this has been recorded on April 13th of 2003. Remember, spitfirelist.com, For the Record, WFMU.org/Dave Emery, and a longer URL, which has the older For the Records available, also for free, on Real Audio. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.